This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The idea of the shiur was really as a follow-on from the Sunday night lecture. And I thought of the idea of actually taking a piece of Gemara and learning it using some of the ideas that we talked about on Sunday night, and I'll review that for those who weren't there. But I just want to thank Rav Waxman for making it possible. I know you're learning Lulavai Gozel. Did we take your time, actually? Is this when you would normally have the Chabur? And since when the idea was discussed, when my son-in-law discussed the idea with Rav Felder, he said, well, then we might as well choose a sugya that some people are involved in already. And that's why we've taken the opening sugya of Lulavai Gozel. You couldn't be involved in a more complex sugya, which is not the one I would have chosen, but that's where it is. So it's a good exercise. The ideas that we discussed on Sunday night that we're revisiting tonight is, I've always believed that apart from those yechidim who really have the opportunity to grow and grow in Torah, most people, ordinary people, should prepare themselves for some form of secular education and capability to be able to earn a living and make a contribution, not just to earn a living, but also to make a contribution. Those who are not able to make a contribution through Torah, because for whatever reason, that's not where their heads are, it's not what they're passionate about, it's not what they love, will carry on learning, but they need to have an area that they are passionate about, that they can make a contribution to the world in. And more recently, I've come to the conclusion that from an educational point of view, the kind of era we're busy moving into is such that there's almost no study more suited to prepare people, young people, older people, to excel in the coming era than Gemara. So that if I were the president of Harvard University and I was looking at the ideal curriculum for Harvard, I would say it should be 60 or 70% Gemara and 30% the other things that people need to learn. That's a shift in the way I've always thought of Gemara. Obviously something we need in order to understand Torah. Now I believe we need Gemara in order to be functional in the world. Which doesn't mean that people who don't have Gemara can't be functional in the world. It simply means those people who do have Gemara can be additionally functional. So I think it's the first time in history that Gemara gives a competitive advantage. Up and fly, oh, Gemara sharpened the mind, it's going to be good thinking. And we know that people with a Gemara cop do well, and that's always been so. But where we are at the moment, Gemara learning, if taught properly, and that's what we'll discuss tonight, even by properly, I don't mean that this is the only way to taught it, I mean teaching it appropriately for this generation and for this era, then Gemara can position a young person for excellence in this world, in this era we're going into, more than any other course he could possibly take at any university. I don't think there's anything he could study that would better prepare him for the future than Gemara. And I suggested on Sunday night that really all a child needs to be learning at school is Gemara, English, and math. And provided his curiosity is kept alive, that's all he needs. He needs Gemara to learn how to think. He needs English to learn how to read and communicate. And he needs math in order to know how to work with technology and science, and just to have the language of technology, and to be able to work with relationships, in conceptual relationships. And then he needs curiosity. So as long as the teacher then is able to keep the curiosity of the child working, that's all it really needs, and that's really all the teacher has to do, because everything else is available. And that it's necessary now for everybody to redefine their jobs. This is an era that we're going into. Everybody has to redefine what they're doing. Because almost anything that people are doing today in any sphere can be done cheaper and more quickly elsewhere, either by automation or by people sitting in China or India or wherever. And that means one has to reconsider exactly what one does. So even in some of the highly skilled areas, In your field, in medicine, I'm sure there are a lot of surgeons, top world surgeons, who are sitting somewhere or other, and they're managing robotically, they're managing And you've got technicians on the spot who are doing what have to be done. Like you, so all of a sudden you find that you don't need the surgeon in every clinic and every the big guys. So you've got a few big guys and they're enough. That's all the world needs. And for the rest of it, it's technology and smaller guys. So people need to redefine what they're offering. So even in areas like surgery, even in areas like medicine, and certainly in the in some of the other areas of endeavor, if what you're doing can be automated or can be done by Indians or Chinese, you'd better think of something else to do. Because the bad news is, it will be automated or done by Indians and Chinese, and much quicker than you think. So everybody is going through a stage now of needing to redefine what it is that they do and what it is that they bring. And teachers are the same. What do teachers used to be? Teachers used to give information to children. Children don't need teachers for that anymore. Whatever information they need, they know how to access. And they can access it quicker than the teachers can, and they can access more information than the teachers ever had. So what is the teacher going to teach them? Stand and repeat, regurgitate stuff that's available on the internet or in textbooks? Why, who needs a teacher for that? So teachers have to redefine what they need to be doing. And the most important thing they need to be doing is fueling the child's curiosity, because if a child is curious, the child will learn whatever the child wants to know. If the child has English and mathematics and a way of thinking, which is what we're suggesting Gemara can do, then anything, hi, come in. Then anything else that the child needs, the child will be able to figure out themselves. Have we used up all the photostats? Are there any spare photostats still? Are they all used? So that's what we discussed. That's what we discussed on Sunday night, and then the idea of tonight is to take a sugya of Gemara, and this is a random sugya. As I said, the sugya is not one that I chose, but it's one that Rabbi Gavriel and his chabura happened to be learning. So that's the one that we took. It happens to be the beginning of a perek, so it's easy to begin to get into it. And the things that I wanted to illustrate to demonstrate how well Gemara prepares the mind for are some of the things we raised on Sunday night and some of the things we didn't, some additional things that we didn't raise on Sunday night. The things we did raise on Sunday night is that the new generation, we said the new generation of people under 25 to 27, think exponentially, they don't think linearly. Again, I'm generalizing, that doesn't mean that everybody under 25 thinks exponentially. It just means the standard way of thinking of an under 25 to 27 year old is exponential. The standard way of thinking of an over 27-year-old is linear. What is Gemara? I claim Gemara is exponential. It's linear and it's exponential. It's both. And we'll see that. The other thing we talked about, yeah?
Can you give an example of the difference between exponential and linear?
Linear is that in order to get a PhD, you have to go to school for 12 years, and then you've got to go to college for 3 or 4 years, and then you've got to do a master's, and then you can do your PhD. Linear is, I can do my PhD now, who needs all that stuff? Exponential. Oh, I don't need a PhD. I can leapfrog the whole system, and I can get, that's what I mean, that's not exactly what exponential means. Exponential also means thinking in all directions simultaneously, not going along a line, 1 plus 1 plus 2, getting everything lined up in a linear fashion. It's being able to think in multi-directional simultaneously. And I'm using the word a bit freely, not in terms of a mathematical definition necessarily. The other thing we said that typifies modern thinking is, or new generation thinking, is hyperlinking. That means the same as we all know what hyperlinking is on the internet, but we think it's just a kind of a technique that you use on the internet. No, it's for the young generation who's actually wired to function technologically. Hyperlinking is a natural way of thinking, and I will argue that Gemara works with hyperlinking too. We'll demonstrate that. The third thing we said was that the new generation has parallel cognitive structures, which means they hold several ideas in their mind simultaneously and think down all tracks simultaneously, and they think across the tracks. Whereas the older generation thinks in one, can hold one idea in its mind, and it finishes the idea, wraps it up, puts it away, and then works with the next idea, wraps it up, puts it away, and then works with the third idea, then pulls all the three ideas out and does what you need to do with it. The new generation thinks parallelly at the same time, and I'm going to demonstrate that that's how the Gemara functions too. And the fourth one was interactivity, that the new generation needs and thinks with interactivity, and of course in Gemara we do that as well with Chavrusa. That's why one has to learn with Chavrusa. It has to be interactive. You can't just sit and stare at a sefer. The additional component that I want to look at this evening is the fact that we've traditionally, in the West, we've traditionally thought very much left brain. Left brain is analytical. So it's already well established. The brain has two hemispheres. The left brain governs primarily the analytical, scientific, numeric way of thinking. And the right brain governs the artistic, the poetic, the intuitive, the more spontaneous side of the human being. And there's been a lot of discussion over the last 20 or 30 years about the relative roles and which is stronger and which is weaker and how they work and how they function. But one thing is clear is in the West, we've focused primarily on left brain. Everything has been measurable. If you're talking about something measurable, you're talking left brain. The right brain doesn't deal with measurable. And thinkers today are arguing that all the left brain stuff is the stuff that technology can do. That it's the left brain stuff that machines can do better than us. So what do we need to excel at? We need to start excelling at right brain stuff, and more importantly, at the connection between left and right brain. So that machines can't do. Machines are not very good at right brain. They can't do right brain at all. The Indians and the Chinese, I imagine, can do right brain as well as anything else. But what we then need to develop the expertise is how to do the combination of left and right brain. What's interesting is, in the United States, the value of physicians, let's say, has it gone up or gone down in the last 15 years? I'm talking about commercial value in the United States. Are they making more money or less money over the last 15 years?
Physicians.
Much less. Much less. The value has gone down. And that's so in almost all the left brain activities. In almost all the left brain activities, the revenue generation capability has gone down. What's interesting that has been pointed out by some writers is, what about nurses? Gone up or gone down? Are they making more or making less? They're making much more than they used to. They're much more in demand. We're importing nurses from the Philippines and we're exporting doctors to China. A lot of the medicine is being, the technological medicine is being exported and the nursing is being imported. Is nursing left or right brain? It's both. It's both, but very heavily right brain. It's the empathy and it's the working with the person, it's the caring for the person, it's the intuitive side. That's the part that's becoming more valuable. As the left brain is becoming less valuable, now this is a massive shift because we've been trained for the last 50 years to develop our left brain because that's how you earn a living. Be an accountant, be a lawyer, be a doctor, be a scientist, be an engineer. That's all left brain stuff. So we've been educated for 50 years or more. Get that left brain stuff going and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on getting yourself degrees in left brain stuff because that's how you earn a living. That's just switched. Very suddenly, right now, it's busy switching. All of a sudden, left brain stuff that machines can do and they can do in Asia. And the part that's difficult is the right brain, or more important, the combination between left and right brain. There's a man called Daniel Pink who's done a lot of amazing work in this area, and he says that there's six capabilities that we need to develop if we want to get good at left and right brain thinking together. And I'm going to mention the six because I'm going to show you how they're in the Sugya of Gomorrah. The one thing he says is design. Design has become very important. And I'm not going to go into a detailed discussion of these. There's a lot to discuss in each of these areas. But design has become very important. Do they have Target stores here in Canada? You don't have Target. It's interesting. Anyway, design has become accessible to the masses, and the masses want design. That's something that they expect at the moment. They want design. The other is story. That if you want to communicate with people, you need to know how to tell stories and listen to stories. Because that's how you communicate, not with facts. We're bombarded with facts. Nobody's listening to facts anymore. Nobody hears facts anymore. Nobody absorbs them anymore. There's just too much. So what do we take in? We take in stories. A maysa we take in, a medrash we take in, a story we listen to. Ask anybody after the Rav's drosha, what do they remember? They'll remember the story. They won't remember the chazal. They won't remember where it came from. They won't remember the main point. They'll remember the story. That's so the story becomes important. The other is the idea that he calls symphony, which is the idea of the opposite of analysis. Analysis is being mechalek, taking things apart. Symphony is to bring things together to show that there's a common yesod for different ideas. Empathy is the way we relate to each other and feel one another. And then meaning, giving meaning to things. People, there's too much information, so now the question is how to make meaning of all of that information. It's something we need to be able to do, and that's a right brain activity. And the other very important one is play. We'll talk about that too. We'll talk about play. In fact, we're going to start with play in the sugya, because the truth is this is a very vast sugya. It's a very vast piece of Gemara. And not all of you are in the sugya, and I'm certainly not in the sugya. It's not what I'm learning at the moment. So we can't get right in as seriously as we might want to. So we're going to have to play with it. We'll play with the Gemara, and let's see what comes out. That's one of the beautiful things of Gemara. If you're not a Rolf Paskin and a Shaila, you can afford to play. You can try something out. If it doesn't work, you take it to pieces again, and you start again. You can put out an idea, you can test an idea. If the idea doesn't work, you drop it and you try something else. That's what you can do. You can play with Gemara. And playfulness is one of the most important dimensions to Gemara learning. If you're not playing with Gemara, then you're missing 9/10 of it. One can afford to play with it. There's no problem with playing with it. You can play with Gemara. And the Maharal says in his Psicha Tetiveres Yisrael, in fact, that's why we say Lasuk B'divrei Torah, and we don't say Lilmud Torah in the Brocha. Because Lilmud Torah is serious. If you're learning Torah, it's got to be the real stuff. Lasuk B'divrei Torah means you're having fun with Torah. You're playing with Torah, you're working with Torah, you're trying things out, you're experimenting with Torah. That's what the mitzvah is. That's what we have to be doing. Lasuk, we have to be busy with Torah. Exploring ideas with Torah. And like any exploration, we don't know where they'll take us. So I'm going to suggest that what we do tonight is we have fun. We just explore the sugya a little bit and see some of the things that come out. And then we'll leave it to the chabura to go back afterwards and figure out if anything was valid or if it was all, if we have to dump it all back in the play bin and start again. But we'll see what comes out. So we'll start with the beginning of the Mishnah. Lulav ha-gozul v'hayovesh posul. A stolen lulav or a dried up lulav is posul. Shall Asheiro v'shel Irani dachas, and a lulav that has been used for an Asheiro tree comes from an Asheiro tree which is used for Avodah Zorah, or Irani dachas, a city that has to be destroyed and is in Cherem because of issues of Avodah Zorah, posel, that lulav is also posel. Niktam Rosho, Nifritzu Olav, if the top of the lulav is broken off or the leaves have split, that's posel. If you do all of kosher, but if they've fanned out, if the leaves are fanned out, the lulav is still kosher. Just leave it over there, because all we're really going to be concerned about are the first two words of the Mishnah, the lulav ha-gozel. But let's just look at the lulav ha-gozel. Let's look at design. Yeah, we'll come into questions of design, because Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, who wrote the Mishnah, used design. All the Torah Shabbat Peh was there. There was a body of information. What he do, he put it together in a certain design. And he called the design Shishay Sidrei Mishnah. This is a Seder. He put them together in a particular design. He used design. So we need design in order to understand Mishnah. So if we look at the design of this Mishnah, something very interesting comes out. Again, playing. I don't know if it's right or wrong yet, but it's a design observation. Lulav ha-gozel v'hayovesh posul. What does that raise? The idea of lulav ha-gozel, among the other examples given of psulim in this Mishnah, does it raise, do you notice anything odd? One of the things in the Gemara is you've got to have a sense of humor, you've got to be playful, and you've got to notice things that are odd, because that's where you find all the chidushim.
The lulav ha-gozel is something that either you might have stolen it.
So beautiful. Beautiful. And your vision Ashera is in the object. It's the object.
Or where it comes from is also within the object.
Within the object, it's Yovesh, it's Asheiro, it's Irani Dachas, it's a psul in the Heftz, it's a psul in the object. What it should say for Lulav HaGozel is HaGozel is HaLulav Lo Yitleno. If a person steals a Lulav, you shouldn't use it on Yom Tov. Can't you? You may not use a Lulav that you've stolen.
Or you could take it the same way. I didn't see it. Someone else stole it. This happened to be, it was stolen from someone.
So there's all discussion whether if somebody else stole it, whether you may use it. Does this apply only to the Ganav, but does it apply to somebody else?
If someone else did something to it, now it's now
and therefore, what will you say about lulav ha-gozel? So it's extended exactly. That's beautiful. Extended to one. And therefore, lulav ha-gozel, you'll say, is what?
Is
a psul in the chefza. That's what the design observation then is, that a stolen object, if you looked at it under a spiritual microscope, would look different from an object that wasn't stolen. The molecular structure would be different. Now that sounds it sounds very absurd. But some of you might have heard. I've forgotten the guy who did this book, but it's very well known. I think it was a Japanese guy who did some molecular photography of water that has had all sorts of different things, including brochas set on it. Are you aware of it? Anybody seen it? It's a magnificent book. And it's not only Jewish brachas, all sorts of. And he shows how the molecular structure of the crystals, the molecular structure of water and crystals of ice, are altered when brachas are said, or when they're used for a davar shebikdusha, or they're used for chesed. He shows actually how the molecules. It's weird. It's really astonishing stuff.
Different.
Completely different. They're completely different. The molecular structure actually changes. It's much more harmonious. It's much more. It's much more symmetrical. He's got the electron microscope pictures. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So we think this is just hocus pocus stuff. But the rest of the world is already studying it scientifically. That the moral context of an object impacts the object. The object changes. So that's what would come just from a design observation in the Mishnah. We would say lulav ha-gozel is similar to ayovesh ha-posel and so on. If it's a stolen lulav, it's a different lulav. There's something in the lulav that is different. And we need to look at a stolen object different, as if its dimensions are different from an object that hasn't been stolen. Now, of course, this is for new generation, this isn't so difficult to understand, because relativity has already done that with time, hasn't it done that? That time can change dimensions. That's something that the older people find difficult to know. Can time change dimension? But time can change dimensions. Well, just as time can change dimensions, so ownership can change dimensions. Where do we see that? We see that in Rashi. If we write, and when you're playing, you assume you're right until you hit a wall, and then you realize you were wrong. But as long as we can go, let's go. So what does Rashi say? Gozel, what is a lulav ha-gozel? Posul, what does it mean, posul? Ulekachtem lochem ksiv mishelochem. Rashi, quoting from the Gemara that Ron says, it says specifically about lulav, that it's got to be lekachtem lochem. You shall take it from your own, from your own, ksiv mishelochem. So when you take a lulav, you've got to take it from those things that belong to you. So if you think of all the objects in the world, that's kind of a set of objects. And there's a subset of those objects, which are the objects of the world that belong to you. It's a subset. So you've got whatever you've got, furniture and clothes and a motor car and a lulav and various other things that belong to you. From that subset, there's still a smaller subset, which is a lulav. So you've got to take a lulav out of the objects that belong to you. That defines what a lulav is. If the lulav is not in the set of things that belong to you, it isn't a lulav. It isn't halakha. For you, it isn't the lulav. In the object, there's something in the object that isn't there. So ulekachtem lochem ksiv mishelochem, it must come from you. If we write in our design concept, then we're going to say that what this teaches us is that by lulav there is a dimensional requirement. There are definitions of what a lulav is. It has to be a palm branch. It has to be a certain freshness. It has to be a certain size. There's certain things as to what a lulav has to be. There's an additional dimension it has to have, the dimension of ownership. It needs to belong to you. That's one of its dimensions of ownership. And if it's gozel, it doesn't have that dimension of ownership. And it's possible in the heftza. There's something in the object that actually makes it possible. So let's go further. We'll go into the Gemara now. So the Gemara says, Koposik v'tani lishna b'yomtiv rishon v'lishna b'yomtiv sheni. The Gemara comes at it now from an analytic perspective. Now we're switching to left brain. Now we're getting analytical, which is the way the Gemara operates. And I need to be makdim something to you that you really that it's really important to understand. And that is that you'll see that I'm going to suggest, as one learns Gemara and teaches Gemara, that one looks for the meaning in it that is beyond the halachic meaning. That you go into the human meaning and the spiritual meaning and the ethical meaning of every piece of Gemara. That's fine. But we can't use that to explain. We can't use that to deduce or extrapolate anything in the Gemara. So you can't. You've got to use left brain to figure something out in the Gemara. You can't come to a conclusion based on right brain. That's when you start getting when you start getting way off track. You start using medrash and drush and imagery to figure out a halacha or to explain it or to be mechadish something in the Gemara. That we can't do. The Gemara is a methodology of analyzing the Gemara, and that methodology is analytical. That methodology is very left brain. However, in creating meaning out of that, once you've established what the Gemara says, what does that mean to me? There we move into right brain. So now the Gemara is switching into left brain. So where we were talking before, when I'm talking about that there's a psul in the Heftza, I'm not using that to create a new halacha. I'm just using that to make meaning out of the design of the Mishnah. So that way I can understand the Mishnah and it starts having some kind of meaning to me. Because what does it mean to me? It means that I've got to look at things as part, I've got to see ownership as part of their dimension. So now, if I'm about to pick up a pen, what do I look at? I look at to see, is it a red pen or a black pen? Because I need a black pen. So I notice if it's red or it's black. I notice if it's a fountain pen or it's a ballpoint pen, because I need a ballpoint pen. I don't want a fountain pen. I notice these things. I've got to notice whether who it belongs to. Is it mine? Is it somebody else's? Is it somebody whose permission I can ask or isn't? Is it hefker? Is it here for general use or isn't it? Those are the dimensions with which I've got to start looking at the world. That's what I learned from this mission. That just as you look at all the other properties of a chefzer, you also look at the moral properties of the chefzer, ownership properties. Who does it belong to? It's one of the things you'll want to know. So that's the right brain stuff. There we're getting into a bit of the artistic side. So we're not going to be mechadesh halachas with that. But to understand the design of a Mishnah, that's very interesting. So that's how we work it. Now we switch back into left brain. The Mishnah is talking about general. It makes a general statement for the whole of Yom Tov. Loishna b'Yom Tov Sheni, Rishon Loishna b'Yom Tov Sheni, doesn't make any differentiation between first day Yom Tov and other days Yom Tov. Bishlomo Yovesh Hodo Beinan Veleka. I understand why the whole of Yom Tov, if the lulav is dried up, it's possible, is because we need hodor, we need a lulav which is mehudar, even for the rest of the Yom Tov in certain instances, and Yovish is one of them. Ela gozel, but what about gozel? Bishlomo Yom Tov Rishon. I understand why you can't have it on Yom Tov Rishon. Dichtiv lochem, mishalochem. Rashi explained why. Because it says lochem. But that it only says about first day when it's Doraisa. That's the only time you need lochem. Ela b'Yom Tov Sheni, amai loy, but on Yom Tov Sheni, in the rest of Sukkos, when you don't need lochem, who cares if it's gozel or not? Asks the Gemara. That's the question. Amar Rabbi Yochim Mishub Rabbi Shimon Yochai. So answered Rabbi Yochim in the name of Rabbi Shimon Yochai. It's got nothing to do with lukachtem lochem. That's not the reason. Even though Rashi said that was the reason, says the Gemara in Rabbi Yochim Mishim Rabbi Shimon Yochai, that's not the reason. It's Mishum Dahavale Mitzvah Habo Ba'averu. This is a different idea altogether. This is a Mitzvah Habo Ba'averu. A Mitzvah that comes out of an Averu. Shenema, where do we learn from that a mitzvah shabo ba'aveira is a problem? And of course, this is now not a problem only on first day. This would be a problem with every mitzvah, all the time. See, in Tosfos, not every mitzvah, not all the time, but it's a generic principle. It's not a principle only for first day Yom Tov. What's the reason? What's the principle with mitzvah?
At this point, we're assuming he stole the lulav, or
it's assume he stole the lulav right through it. We'll just make it easier because you get into a machlokes as to whether. It becomes a problem for somebody else or not. Mitzvah, ba'aver shenema, where do we get it from? Veheveisem gozul ve'sapiseach ve'sachile. Would you bring a stolen animal, or a lame animal, or a sick animal as a korban? Dumye de piseach. This is like a piseach. But just pause there a moment. So what do we see with mitzvah, ba'aver? Is it in the chefetz or in the gavra? Is it a problem with the chefza, with the object, or with the subject? Object. That's a mum. It's a mum. So on that we see we're on track. Even though it's not because of Mishelochem, so we've got to set that aside. Now do you see parallel cognitive structures coming in? We developed an idea thinking along Mishelochem. And we, because of the design of the Mishnah, thought maybe it's chefza. We're keeping the chefza piece, flipping to mitzvah abo ba'aver, or putting aside the lokachtem lochem. We're not using that for the moment. Parallel structures. Keep it in mind. We'll come back to it. But we're on another structure right now. We're on the structure of mitzvah abo ba'aver. But that which we said from a design perspective, that there's an object problem with it. A stolen object has a problem with it in itself. And we thought the problem was ownership, lochem. No, now we're coming on to a slightly different definition. It's mitzvah abo ba'aver. There is avero in the object, and that's a mum. Just as in a korban, if it's pisach or chile, a sick korban or a lame korban, that's a problem with the object. Gozel is the same. It's an ugliness in an object. It's aesthetically unappealing. And you wouldn't bring a korban that's aesthetically unappealing. It's ugly. It's morally ugly. Some things are ugly from an aesthetic perspective. Some things are ugly from a moral perspective. Now you might find, I'm sure you've had examples of that in your own life, where you look at something and it looks quite nice, and somebody who's very aesthetically sensitive comes and says, oof, the colors clash, it looks so ugly. Have you ever had that? Have you ever had something like that? So what does that mean? You're not sensitive enough to the aesthetics of it. To you it looks okay. You're not that fussy. You're not you're not makpid on glut when it comes to aesthetics, only when it comes to kashrus. But somebody who is makpid on glut when it comes to aesthetics will look at it and say, this isn't good enough. It just isn't good enough. It doesn't go together. It doesn't match. The color's not attractive. The fabric's not attractive. Whatever it is. So it is with moral aesthetics. We're not tuned in to find things that are morally not okay as ugly. We are tuned to say, no, it's our morality, their morality, they've got their way of doing it, we've got our, and we learn to tolerate it. It's like tolerance being, we don't tolerate ugliness. You tolerate ugliness, you say, no, if in your house you want something ugly, that's your business, you can have something ugly. But tolerate ugliness doesn't mean I'll tolerate it in my house. I don't have to tolerate ugliness in my life. And so it is with moral ugliness. So we've got to become sensitive to moral ugliness, which is like Pisach and Chole. But it goes further than that. Gozel dumya de Pisach, says the Gemara. Ma Pisach les le takanto, av gozel les le takanto. You can't undo the mum of Pisach and Chole. You can't undo that mum. In the same way, you can't undo the gozel mum. It is such a flaw in the object. If it was just a flaw in the subject, he could do tshuva. And it gets fixed. But this isn't a flaw in the subject. You can do whatever tshuva you want. The thing retains its mum. So much so, lo yishna lifnei yayush v'lo yishna l'achar yayush. It doesn't even matter if there's yayush. What is the din with yayush? If the nignav, the person from whom the object was stolen, gives up any hope of recovery, the object becomes becomes owned by the ganav. That's the din. That doesn't mean he isn't obligated to compensate the nignav, of course he does have to, but the object itself transfers ownership and belongs to the ganav the moment the nignav gives up any kind of hope of recovery. So what would be the din here? If it was...
If you're going to point to what Rashi said, Lachem,
right.
Now it flips back to being...
If we were, now we're on our parallel structures. If the whole problem was Mishalochem, then if ownership goes to the ganav, that would be okay, says the Gemara, but this is not Shalochem. And here the problem is Mitzvah Boba Aveiro, and therefore even if ownership flips back to the ganav, the object retains its ugliness. The moral ugliness, the mum of Geneva, remains attached to the object even afterwards. Yes, then the ugliness would go. But you can't use it.
You can never fix it, right?
So you answer that. That's great. Use what we've already used tonight to answer that. It's a good kasha. Use what we've already used tonight to answer that. Why is that not called, why is returning the object not called reversing the mum? Now you're going to work on parallel structures. Now you've really got to work with both of them. Even though we've dropped the one, conceptually, we've still got to work it. And my Rosh Hashiva used to teach me when we used to learn, you've got to work with Havaminas. Even if the Gemara discards a Havamina, the reason for which it's discarded is the only thing you push aside. But everything else that you reasoned using that Havamina, that all stays in place. You keep that in your mind as you go on. So even though we've put Lekachtem Lochem aside, let's use it. What did we say about Lochem is that ownership defines dimension. So, if you've got a lulav, and I steal it from you. That's now got a mum. And you're miyayish. So the lulav belongs to me. So in terms of lochem, the dimensions of this lulav is it's four tfochim high, and it's half an inch thick, and it's fresh, and it's this, and that, and the other, and it's mine. Those are its dimensions. If I return it to you, is it the same object or a different object? It's a different object. So I haven't removed the flaw from my object. I've changed the object. And that's why shinui, when you change the object, you do remove the flaw. So even though yeush doesn't work, we see in the Rishonim, in the Gemara itself, further on, right in the very next piece of Gemara, that if there's a shinui maise or there's a shinui rishus, there are other shinuim which do away with the flaw because the object is no longer the same object. But if the object is the same object, you can't remove the flaw, is what the Gemara wants to say here. Loshna lifne yush, loshna acha yeush. Bishlomo lifne yeush. I understand before yeush why there's a flaw. Odom ki yakriv michem. You might say the reason is because of michem. By a korban there's also a law like lochem. Omer achmonde v'lav dideyu. It's not his. Elo la'acha yeush or kanya be yeush. But after yeush he's been koina. Elo lav mishum davali mitzvah abo ba'avero. The problem is mitzvah abo ba'avero. And mitzvah abo ba'avero is an aesthetic flaw a morally aesthetic flaw that doesn't get removed with Yayush. Says Rashi, Ma pisachen lo itakona l'ach hazman l'akriva sharei mum kavua ulomisu. What's it in with pisach? It's a mum kavua ulomis. It's a permanent mum that will never go away. Af gozul yalfinen minei de'in lo itakona l'ach hazman va'afilu b'yeyush t'shaminen leila maradim yayish v'omo v'ayli l'chisor in kis. Even if we heard the owner say, oh yeah, I've lost this money, I'll never get it back. V'afal gav v'li'inyin mikni amrinim b'bovikama de'kani lei b'yeyush. From the laws of Kenyan, from laws of Kenyan, it belongs to the Ganav. V'havi didei, and it's his. V'afilu hachi kruvu l'mizbeach loy, but it's too ugly to bring to the mizbeach. There's something it retains, even though there's been a legal transfer of ownership. There's something ugly that it retains, which makes it still like a pisach or a chile. It's morally sick. It's morally imperfect, and you can't bring it on the mizbeach. And the same will apply with the lulav, was what the Gemara wants to say. Is that left brain or right brain? Is that kind of stuff?
The last comment was right brain.
Now we're in right brain again. This is right brainy kind of stuff. And it's parallel structure. We're thinking of mum and we're thinking of psulim. Now look what the Gemara does. And Rabbi Yochanan b'shum Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, "May dichtiv ki ane Hashem oyev mishpat soine gezel ba'avlo." Boilo, what is this that Hashem says, I love mishpat and I hate theft in an oilo? Moshe lemelech bosovedom. This is like a king, a human king. Shehoyo over al beis hameches, who walks through customs. Arrived in the country and he goes through customs. Omer la'avod of tnu meches lemechsin. He says, go through the red, we've got things that we should be declaring. So go through the red lane and declare what we need to declare. Omru levaloi kol hameches kulu shilchol. They say to him, but it's all yours. What? Who are you going to pay meches to? You, the government. So then you're getting it. Why do we have to go through the red? I want all the travelers to learn from me. So that they do not try to evade taxes. That's a beautiful phrase. What does yavrichu min hagezel mean? What does Havrachat Meches mean? This is where it comes from. It's a modern Hebrew term as well. Tax evasion. Right? The Israeli accountants will tell you. Havrachat Meches comes from the Gemara. It means evasion of tax. We don't evade taxes. We evade Gezel. With as much ingenuity as one evades taxes. The Gemara is teaching us here you should employ an accountant to make sure that nothing in your among your assets has come to you in a way which has a chashash Gezel. To evade Gezel the way other people evade taxes. Look how much effort and money we put into evading taxes. Says the Gemara, that's the effort that we should put into evading Gezel. I'll never forget when the first time I gave some money, somebody asked me to give some tzedakah away, and I gave it to Rav Meir Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav's son. And I asked him to, because he gives out tzedakah for not only his own ways, but for other people he gives out. So I thought he would be very happy. I brought him some money and I thought he would be very happy. And he would say thank you and give me a receipt and that would be the end of it. He put me through an interrogation like you cannot imagine. Do I know the people? Do I know their business? Is there a chashash gezel? Is there any possibility that the money that I'm giving him could have come to them in a way that was dishonest? Could it be that it could have come to them in a way that was dishonest that they don't know? Because if you're in any doubt, he said to me, please give it to somebody else or give it back to them. I don't want it. Only if you're absolutely sure and you're willing to give me your word that you know that this is kosher money, am I willing to take it? That's what it is. Havrachas Gezel. To evade Gezel the way business people evade taxes. That's what we need to do. Now what brought us onto the story? Why do we need the story here? Is there something missing in the Gemara before we got the story? Is the Torah telling us something left? If we're in left brain, is there any analysis that this story is adding that we didn't have up till now?
I have a question. What does it mean? Soine gezel ba'olah. Why daft and olah?
Why do you mean the positive?
Why olah? Soine gezel ba'olah. We need the story to illustrate. One of the qualified questions in the positive. Ani Hashem soine gezel ba'olah.
Right.
So you say, Ani Hashem soine gezel.
But where does that posuk come from? Where did we first encounter that posuk? That's because we brought it. That's only after Va'omar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai. If he wouldn't have brought it all together, we wouldn't be talking about the posuk. Why even raise the posuk? Why even raise the posuk? So the whole piece from Va'omar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai, I'm asking, why is it here?
Well, show us why Gezel is discussing like Isaiah.
We need to know why.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Do we need to know that?
Because if we hold that Yeush can flip it back and therefore can change it back, and maybe you could use it, use the lulav. What we're saying is no, because it's a fault in the chefza, and Gezel is a moral blemish. Then you have to run away from that kind of.
Understand? It illustrates what we've been saying. It's an illustration, but it's not necessary for analysis purposes. I would suggest this is a good example. Sorry.
I mean, it might be necessary because if you really look at the both Nahorim are made by Rabbi Yochanan.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
But the first one you can challenge. You can say maybe relationship to God when we bring a korban, maybe it's different than. Doing a mitzvah with a lulav, maybe we should use different principles. So here he comes to sort of repeat the idea, but here he tried to tell you that this idea of accepting a korban is the same idea as accepting a mitzvah.
But that link he's already made in the first one, because he brings the raya from korbanos. The posuk in Malachi is from korbanos. So that linkage is already made.
Right,
he emphasized. So it's a third, it's an expansion, but it's not something that is necessary.
There's also a possibility that because of Ola is something that there's no part of it comes back to you. That perhaps you might have thought by a regular korban that you still get the E part of it. So
there's a bit of Ben Odom the Chaveri in it.
But by an Ola, since all of it's going to Hashem, you might have thought.
I understand. You're giving good pshat in Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum, Rabbi Shimon, and Yochai. In other words, if we've got this piece of Gemara, then Rabbi Gavriel's question, why Dafka Ilon? Are you giving a bit of an answer to what you're going into an analysis of Rabbi? But I'm asking, why even bring Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum, Rabbi Shimon, and Yochai? And what's the fault? What's the fault? What's the fault that this corrects? All those things could be, but it's also possible that this is a hyperlink. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai elsewhere made similar comments about a similar subject. Imagine you were on the internet, and imagine you were reading and it quoted the first one. Om Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. You would have a blue thing under Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Isn't that so? And if you clicked on it, what would be the first thing that would come up in the list of references, do you think? This one. Because this is the most closely linked. It's Rabbi Shimon, it's the same, it's Rabbi Yochanan Mishum, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. It's on the topic. It's on the topic of the mumin and an object. It's why Hashem finds it despicable. Is it a logical place to put it if you're thinking linearly? No, you don't need it linearly. You don't need it if it's linear. Is it a logical place to put it because you've got a piece of information and you want people to know? Why would you want people to know this more than what went before? What's interesting? What has the Gemara done here that it hasn't done before?
I kind of grapple with this one. The 1800 pre-hyperlink. They do grapple with this. Why do we need the second Shem and Yochai more than the first?
You know what I'm finding very interesting, as I'm going into this, I'm finding that there's much more hakpoda on Seder in the Mishnah than there is in Gemara. Very often the Gemara will give up. We'll try and find a connection, and very often there isn't a connection. And very often it will say, it's just a list of ma'amorim that the same Tana said, that the same Amora said. And sometimes not even on similar subjects, sometimes on completely dissimilar subjects. And the Rishonim and Achrayim find no similarity between them. Often there'll be a list, v'omar, all over the place.
Yeah.
And you've got it. So yes, you will try to see, is there a conceptual linkage? All I'm saying, there's not a hechrech to find the conceptual linkage. Because if there isn't, let's see what it's added. What has it added? Use some of my introductory comments to figure out what has it added. Yeah, don't forget, what I'm trying to do is to show you, to demonstrate specifically, I'm not saying this is the only way to learn Gemara, I'm just saying specifically for the ideas we've been talking about, what is this adding that we haven't had up till now? Story and empathy. This is not fact, this is not left brain analysis, this is a maisa. It employs a different part of our brain. Now all of a sudden I have a king going through the red line in the customs. I can relate to it. I can see it. I can feel it. This is a drosha. This is a Friday night or a Shabbos drosha in shul. This is a musa. This is a musa shmuz. All of a sudden it sticks in a musa shmuz. Do we need it? No, you don't need it to understand the Gemara. but it creates meaning. Do you see how we're employing all of those six elements? It gives meaning. It's left, it's right brain, it's story, and it's empathy. I can relate to it. I can understand it.
Connection. Why he's bringing, you know, if there is a connection, that's also right brain thinking.
Yes. Now you might have to think.
This one's a little more closer, but sometimes, like you said, there's
the way out.
And it has nothing to do with
that symphony. That symphony.
And they still try and find the connection.
So that symphony. Now you take two way out things that don't seem to be connected, and you explore. Is there a common yesod? And even here, there's common yesod. It's not completely way out. There's symphony. There's common yesod. So you're taking a mimer of Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai. Do you think he said it when he was teaching Lulav HaGozel? He wasn't. He probably said it in Kodshim, or he said it on the Parsha, on the Shabbos Shmuz. Who knows where Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai said it, and where Rabbi Yochanan heard it. But the Gemara brings it over here, because this is the place where we're working with these concepts. So there's a conceptual relationship of packaging it together here while you're busy with Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai, on matters of Gezel being a psul in the Heftza. Click on the hyperlink, and you know what? There's something else, which is there some kind of connection? Sure, there's a connection. There's a conceptual connection. Do you need this in order to explain the first piece linearly? No. Do you need this in order to give meaning to the first piece and to make it feel more real? Yes, you do. That's what it does. So you now think of a child learning this, and how much of his brain is being employed, and you tell me what other limud in the entire world, in a matter of 30 minutes, could be employing so many different parts of the child's brain, or an adult's brain for that matter. Thinking, left brain, right brain, moving backwards and forwards, linear and exponential. Hyperlinking and not hyperlinking. Creating symphony and separating things out. Look what's going on here in the brain. And we're just skimming the surface. We're not even starting to learn yet. Let's go a little bit further. What's our timeline? 9:30, do we need to be finished? 9:35. Let's go a little bit further. It's quite interesting. Just a piece of Tosfos. I want you to look at the Ve'im Tomer in Tosfos, which is about seven lines from the top of the first Tosfos on Daf Lamed. Ve'im Tomer asks Tosfos, "Lekanon de paslina luluv shel asherah v'shel irah nidachas mishum de michtas shiurei." There's a technical reason further on why a luluv that belongs to an asherah and irah nidachas is possible. It's because of size, and it's technical stuff, structural stuff. Asks Tosfos, typically mishum mitzvah abor ba'avera. After all, it's a mitzvah abor ba'avera. Why do you have to get onto all those technical things? If it's not the specific type of asherah, of an asherah the Moshe, we allow it. Why would we allow it? It's mitzvah abor ba'avera. So Tosfos answers that. Yishlema delay dami legezel. No, Gezel is a different kind of mitzvah ba'avera. Why? The machmas averas ha-gezel bo'a ha-mitzvah. So Tosfos narrows down the idea of mitzvah ha-bo'a ba'avera. Now we have trouble with this, don't we? Because Tosfos is now being very technical, and Tosfos is saying, only a mitzvah ha-bo'a ba'avera where the avera gave birth to the mitzvah is a problem. So you've got to steal the lulav in order to be yotze with the lulav. If you don't get your hands on the lulav, you can't be yotze on the lulav. So you steal it as a means of being mekayim the mitzvah. But if the lulav came from an asherah, is it because it came from an asherah that you can keep the mitzvah? There's no connection. There's no linkage between the avera and the mitzvah. If there's no linkage between the avera and the mitzvah, it's not a mitzvah abo ba'avera, says Tosfos. That's a little bit difficult for us, isn't it? Because if we say an avera creates a moral psul, what's the difference? What kind of avera? If it's the way it facilitates the mitzvah, if it doesn't, so what are we going to do with Tosfos' kasha? So those of you.
We're not saying that asherah is not a psul.
Yeah, but it's not a psul because of mitzvah abo ba'avera. It's a different psul.
It's a different psul.
But philosophically, it should be the way we're talking about it. If we're right, this is one of the situations where our playfulness might hit a stone wall. Where you're trying something and you're coming out. If we're right. Makes the Tosfos' kasha a little difficult.
It doesn't bother me. So here you have a psul that you have the avera which was enabled me to do mitzvah, and here I have an avera.
True.
It's some avera, but it creates a different kind of psul.
You're right. One could work with it. One could still work with it, but we don't have to go that far. I'm rushing a little bit just to expose you to a few of the thoughts here. Those of you who've got a Perush HaMishnayos of the Rambam, we'll see what the Rambam says in the opening. Now, how the Rambam learns the Gemara further on, I don't yet know. You'll probably work that out. But one thing I do know is how the Rambam learns the Mishnah, in Perush HaMishnayos at least. What does he say? He starts off, first statement, mitzvah habo ba'avero eino mitzvah. A mitzvah that comes through an avero is not a mitzvah. Ulefichach, and therefore, lulav ha'gozul v'shel asher v'shel dachas posul. What's the reason he says an asher and an dachas is posul? Tak a mitzvah habo ba'avero, that's why. In the Mishnah, as I say, how he learns the Gemara, I don't know yet, but that's how he learns the Mishnah. Now that leads us to an interesting thing further on in Tosfos. At the very end of Tosfos, Tosfos is left with a kasha which he doesn't answer. What's Tosfos' kasha? Umiu, about five lines from the end of Tosfos. Tema. There's one thing that remains difficult. The fairy called Shoim Psochim, the Tanya, Ein Yotze Yidei Matzo Betevel. You cannot be Yotze Matzo Betevel. Tevel is matzah from which Truman Meiser hasn't been taken. Can't be Yotze. Again, using our idea, remember what I said, we can't use the philosophic ideas to reason with, but still we've got to test them. If you've got a philosophic idea that doesn't work in halacha, then the philosophy is wrong. It doesn't mean you can't make chidushim out of the philosophy, but if halacha doesn't support the philosophy, then the philosophy is wrong. So, what would you say, without looking at Tosfos, and those of you who know Tosfos, just forget it for a moment. What would you say? I have wheat from which Truman Meiser hasn't been taken. I bake it into matzah. I use it on first night Pesach for the matzah shel mitzvah. Is that a mitzvah be'avera based on our philosophic concepts of tonight?
It's a
shovel test. Yeah, nothing's been done. No avera has been done in the matzah. It's just something that should have been done hasn't yet happened. Is it ugly? Is there an aesthetic ugliness? If you had that kind of sensitivity that we're talking about, that you're super sensitive to moral ugliness, and you can look at the lulav ha'gozel and you can say, yuck, just look at it, it's filthy. Somebody else would say, what do you mean it's filthy? It's a beautiful lulav. It's beautiful, can't you see this? It's full of gazela. Where do you see gazela? I can see gazela, like Rabbi Pinchas ben Yo's donkey. You can see these things. So what would happen with tevel if you looked with your spiritual, your sensitive soul, if you looked at tevel, would you look at it and say, yuck, look at this? But you're not eating it. It's not possible for anything. A kohen can eat it.
For you,
so you can't eat it. If I saw you eating it, sorry. Yeah. So let's say it's only the truma hasn't been taken from it. So then he could eat it. Only the meiser hasn't been taken from it. Levi can eat it. It's not inherently evil. There's not a mum in it. There's something that has to be done. It hasn't gone through a last stage of hachona. It only becomes ugly when you eat it. But until you're eating it, there's nothing ugly about it. It's raw material that hasn't been fully manufactured, hasn't been fully processed, that's all. There's a step in the process, it hasn't had.
You can say the same thing about lulav. You can say there's nothing ugly about lulav or gazel by itself.
Why?
The only reason it becomes ugly is because they won't use it.
No, it's already, it's a chefetz ha'gozel. It's already, an avera's been done on it already. An avera's been done, you've been over.
You're right. What's the concept of...
But no avera's been done on the tevel. No avera's been done on the tevel. What's ugly about it? So you can't eat it. So you can't eat it. Not a big deal. So you can't eat it. So it can't be used for matzah. So it can't be used for matzah unless you'll take truma meiser. But the moment you take truma meiser, you can use it for matzah. There's nothing. There's not a mum she'ena over. Is there any similarity between that and pisach and chole? There's absolutely no similarity. Says Tosfos, v'darish lemikro tepuk lemishu mitzvah bo ba'avera. This should be a mitzvah bo ba'avera. The koachin is sort of an afik yidei matzah. According to my definition, says Tosfos, this should be a mitzvah bo ba'avera, but it isn't. And I'm not sure how the Rambam would hold it. Based on the Rambam and Perish HaMishnah, it's possible it isn't, because he's got a different definition. The Rambam's definition of mitzvah bo ba'avera clearly is different from Tosfos, because he doesn't have Tosfos as kasher from Asherah. He learns that it is because of mitzvah habo ba'avera. Therefore, his definition is different. If the definition is different, that's the only way you're going to avoid Tosfos as kasher. When Tosfos is left with the Tzorich Iyun, that means if you define things the way I've defined them, there is a question that cannot be answered. Because if it could be answered, he would answer it. If it can't be answered, there's something in the definition that is different. And one would have to define the whole concept of mitzvah habo ba'avera differently in order to get to that. We haven't been able to get into the other piece of Gemara, which is the Lachem, and a bit of the Stira in the Rambam itself, which is another piece. But I think it's at least a little bit of a demonstration of just the amazing spiritual and mental and intellectual acrobatics that you need to do to be able to work with the sugya, that by the time you've been through it, it's like you've been to gym and exercised every part. You know, sometimes you go for a workout and sometimes you go and you just work out upper body, you work out lower body. It's a good workout, but sometimes you go and you work out everything. You come out and you just feel everything's worked out. You've learned a piece of Gemara, and it's any piece of Gemara. There's no piece of Gemara that's any different from this. Any piece of Gemara, you're worked out spiritually, you're worked out emotionally, you're worked out relationship-wise, you're worked out left brain, you're worked out right brain, design, story, empathy, meaning, play. You've used it all in an hour of learning of Gemara, of one little piece of Gemara. We've used it all. A person who's raised, who's thinking this way all day, 60-70% of his day, this is what he's trained in. These are the very things that one needs in order to be able to operate in the world as we're going forward. The capacity to be able to do all this at the same time is what the people who are going to excel in the new kind of world that we're going into are going to be able to do better than anybody else. And that gives you an idea for two reasons. Firstly, it gives you an idea of how Gemara positions us. But more important, I believe it's the only way to really understand Gemara. But if we're going to try and learn Gemara linearly, I was saying to Rabbi Felder and Rabbi Simon the other evening, it's a pity. We've taken Gemara, and since the time of the explosion of Baalei Tshuva and a lot of the Sifrei Ezer, the way we try and help people learn, whether it's with the art scroll works or the various other works, we've taken Gemara with its complex structures that we've just learned, and we've made it linear so that Western people can understand it. But all these diagrams and these things, where did we have such things before? So I'm not suggesting a new way of learning. I'm suggesting we dump the new way because it's shallow and get back to the old way because that's modern. The way we used to learn in yeshivas, that's the modern way to be learning. That was part of it. I think maybe it was the other way around. Once there were linear ways of learning, you can learn daf yomi because you can get through it quickly. It's all linear. If you have to learn this way, you can't learn daf yomi. So one of the things that we've taken Gemara and pushed it into a Western mind instead of taking a Western mind and pushing it into Gemara. Take a Western mind and push it into Gemara, it becomes an exponential mind. Becomes a genius mind. If you take Gemara and you shove it into Western linear thinking, you're making nothing out of Gemara. So I think we've got to revisit the way we're teaching children Gemara, the way we're teaching adults Gemara, the way we're learning ourselves, and get back to the authentic ways of learning Gemara. It's harder, much more challenging, but it opens up ways of thinking that will enable you to see your life and the world in a different light. Yeah.